In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
Rise and shine, fever dreamers. Look alive, my friends. I'm V Spear.
And I'm Sammy Sage.
And this is American Fever Dream, presented by Betches News,
where we explore the absurdities and oddities of our uniquely American experience. Today, we are bringing you a temp check on our newest piece of Americana, the Tortured Poets Department, a breakdown of how some states are making an attempt to get our presidents elected based on the popular vote. Imagine that. And how our old friend Louis DeJoy is back, still trying to get rid of your mail.
We have not seen such a threat to the mail since Anthony Comstock.
Honestly, I don't think we've seen such a threat to the mail since email was invented.
I know.
Speaking of email, we got some amazing emails this week. We are going to read one later in our down ballot segment, so stay tuned.
Yes, please email us. It is my favorite thing that we do. And Sammy, we are 2 days away from American Fever Dream taking Washington, D.C. How excited are you for White House Correspondents Weekend?
I am extremely excited. First of all, our itinerary is stacked. We are going to be going from place to place to place.
Club, bus, another club.
Literally us. We should make that TikTok when we're there. We have many plans for fun content. If anyone who's listening is there, come say hi to us. If you see us, if you spot us, or email us where you might be, and we'll, you know, try to arrange something. We're really excited about it.
We'll be the ones gawking at everyone, being completely awkward, dressed up, and just like so happy to be here.
We're just happy to be here. You know, thanks for having us. Thank you so much, Ambassador, for having us here. We are incredibly excited.
It's going to be a good fun time. But while we're up top of the episode here, we do have some exciting housekeeping. As you know, we want to keep making the show better every week. And one of the things that we are trying to do to make it better is make this podcast as ADHD friendly as possible. So starting today, you will be able to check our descriptions for timestamps that reference the topics we discuss on these episodes. So if there's something that you're super eager to get to, or something you want to like go back to and listen to again, you'll be able to go to the episode notes, look at the timestamps, and then listen to that part that you are most excited for. That way, if you don't want to hear us talk about Taylor Swift for the next 15 minutes, you can go ahead and skip ahead.
We had to release this feature just in time for this conversation about Taylor Swift, because as many Swifties as are out there, there are so many people who are just like, I do not want to hear you talk about her at all. I'm aware. I've gotten the feedback. So for those of you who don't, check out the timestamps to listen to the next conversation, which is about the Electoral College. Mm-hmm. Incredibly important. And for those of you who do want to hear about it, tune into today's Temp Check. Here we go.
This is a podcast by two white American women. So, of course, we're going to be talking about Miss Taylor, Allison Swift. And if you aren't interested, again, go ahead and use those timestamps and skip ahead. But Sammy, I know that you've been a Swiftie for such a long time. You and I have spent countless hours digging into this album. What do you think about the Tortured Poets Department?
I'm going to try not to fangirl too excessively, but I love this album. It's very much, I mean, part of it is that it's just very much my taste in music, like calm with some soaring bridges, but not too much, not too many intensive beats. It's long, so I can kind of just leave it playing. It doesn't necessarily bother me, so it works as background music. I know that some people feel that it was like a bit bloated or the songs sound the same, and I definitely can like hear that criticism. But again, it's just frankly my taste. But most importantly, I felt that the songwriting on this album was much less clunky and less heavy-handed than it was on Midnights. So I liked it more than Midnights. And I think that also her perspectives seem to have matured. I trust her perspectives in her writing. Mm-hmm. And the way she talks about herself and her narrative and her feelings more than I trust the things that are said in People magazine. What's interesting is that people say, like, you need to understand her lore to understand what this album is about. And that is 100% valid, because what she does kind of like off season, so to speak, when she's not releasing her albums, is that she's building the content and the background story of those albums. So she doesn't end up telling those stories as much lyrically, mm-hmm. and they're told more through like tabloids. Mm-hmm. But that said, I do feel that this album is more self-aware. I think that she was unafraid to be a little bit unhinged and dark and funny. And my favorite Taylor Swift has always been the one who knows how to joke about herself in song, especially like Blank Space and Antihero and I Bet You Think About Me. Like that video is really funny. Mm-hmm. And I think there were a lot of great songs on it, even if there were some that might not like immediately shine out of all 31 songs. But clearly she can't help but sing and write. So what did you think?
I thought many things, and my thoughts kind of like evolved over the time that I spent listening to it. The first time I listened to it, I didn't like it. I listened to it and I kind of was like, oh man, because I was in my head about like, how is she going to tour this? And what would the concert experience be like, which really doesn't matter at that point. And I felt that same thing, like, oh, every song feels the same and it's very slow. And I don't know what I was expecting. I think because I wasn't expecting anything, I like disappointed myself by not having an expectation or like previously looking it up. But then I listened to it a second time and I loved it and I got it. And I understood sort of like the space that she created for us to be imaginative, to be vulnerable. And Taylor Swift is the type of artist who really allows herself to kind of be that dartboard for people to put their own feelings and experiences on. And you can pull out one little lyric that really means something to you and then apply it to your life. And I found that very interesting and comforting. And to your point, I loved that it was a long album. What I didn't like the first time I listened, because I was rushing, trying to hear every single song at once, I loved on the second one, because it was this thing where you could just kind of put it on and walk away. You didn't have a responsibility to being like deeply present the whole time.
Because it's also hard to digest an album without the what people are talking about. Because, you know, even as you're listening, you're scrolling on your phone, you're reading comments. For some reason, my Spotify wouldn't load for like, I don't know, 5 minutes or something. So I'm seeing people talking about Charlie Puth. I'm like, oh, like I'm already seeing something. Like I try to listen more than I'm looking at other things. Mm-hmm. And I was really tired this time. Like I wasn't able to stay up through both. So I was able to like really listen more and not like read so much on my phone this time. So what's your history as a Swiftie? Just out of curiosity.
Very like the older sister, cool older cousin. So Taylor Swift is just a little bit young for me. So I'm 41, but my sister is only like 37. And I feel like Taylor Swift sits perfectly for her, where I was more of like an authentic leading Britney Spears person, Christina Aguilera person, Lana Del Rey person even. She was a little bit more of like a Taylor Swift person. So I like it in the way that like I want to know what my sister's into and I want to know what the people just a little bit younger than me are into because I encourage them and their music tastes and I want to stay relevant and cool and young. I sort of am like a distant Taylor Swift watcher up through, I would say, maybe like the last two albums.
I see what you're saying. Like, I guess maybe my relationship to like Sabrina Carpenter is sort of like your relationship to Taylor Swift, which I think makes it harder to connect with because when I'm listening, I'm not just listening the way if I listen to like an Ariana Grande album, I'm like, okay, what do I like think of this? I'm looking for clues. She makes you an investigator. She invites you with distance into her world. And that's why the brand is so strong and so lucrative. It's that she gives you so much, but still keeps people at a distance. So everyone feels like they really understand her. Not everyone, but like, you know, her strongest fan base. And years ago, she's been very intimate with fans too.
Yeah.
So like she has done like more personal outreach, I would say, than your average pop star and like had people to her house. So you, there's this dynamic of people wanting to be like noticed by her.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that has made it sort of hard for there to be almost unfiltered conversation around her art. Like Paste Magazine didn't put a byline on their review because one instance when they reviewed her album, the writer got like so much hate because they criticized it.
Wow.
So Swifties are a little crazy. Sorry, don't come for me.
I think it's okay to be crazy about something though, because there's so few opportunities for this type of engagement. And it's the one time where even somebody like me, who's more of like a tangential fan, who's a fan of the fans, if anything, like I'm a fan of the Taylor Swift fans. I love watching y'all go crazy over this and I want to be included in it and whatnot. She created appointment listening, right? Like there's this one thing that we're all going to listen to and then we're going to talk about. And I think there are so few opportunities in American culture right now where we all watch something the way that like in the 90s, we used to all watch like TGIF. And then we could talk about the very special episode of Full House. This is the very special episode of Taylor Swift that whether you're a fan or not, you have to know about it to be able to contribute to society.
I think most people who are fans of Taylor Swift are not like that toxic breed where they're like threatening to kill Joe Alwyn.
Today's episode of American Fever Dream is brought to you by Nuuly. Have you ever felt that fast fashion ick, but can't always afford the super high-end stuff? I have a solution for you. It's Nuuly. Nuuly has everything you need to bring your closet up to speed for the season without breaking the bank. Free your closet of impulse purchases and skip the buyer's remorse by renting instead. Nuuly is a subscription rental service, and for just $98 a month, you get your choice of any six styles. They also have inclusive sizing up to 5X, as well as petite and maternity. You get fast, free shipping and returns and professional cleaning in Nuuly's state-of-the-art laundering facility. No laundry for you to worry about. This is the best. You just put it back in your box, send it out, and before you know it, you've got your next one. And you always have the option to buy what you love for sometimes up to 75% off. I bought the Rachel Antonoff pasta puffer from them. I was obsessed with it, like everybody who tries it is, and it was completely sold out everywhere else. So I felt like I really, really had an in there. So thank you, Nuuly. Nuuly is an amazing value at $98 a month for any six styles. And right now you can get $20 off your first month of Nuuly when you sign up with the code FEVERDREAM20. Just go to NUULY.com. That's Nuuly with two U's, and enter the code FEVERDREAM20 and sign up to get $20 off your first month. That's NUULY.com, Nuuly with two U's with code FEVERDREAM20. Nuuly subscription clothing rental, change your clothes.
For the most part, she gives women a space to interpret their own feelings and gives credibility to it and is saying, like, my feelings matter. Mm-hmm. And while none of us can really relate to her, she teaches us what fame feels like. And people get on her case about the way she does that and her making herself a victim. And she wrote about that in what is my favorite song, Who's Afraid of Little Old Me. I think that is just such a magnum opus. One might, that for me, she teaches us like what it feels like. And even though it's so easy to be like, what a privileged woman trying to make herself a victim, it's still valid. It's still interesting. Like, why should we turn that around? But speaking of appointment listening, last time we had that was Beyonce's Cowboy Carter. And people tend to bring them up in conjunction with each other. And while some people want to make that competitive, I think that's very unnecessary because Beyonce is, I think she makes music for the macro level. She teaches us about history. She gives context to her music. She gives context to her community. She is speaking about more than herself, really. She's telling a tale. Taylor is telling a tale for the micro, for people to understand their own emotions, for her to grapple with herself, and for people to do the same through her experience. We need both of those things. And I think there's a space for both of those things.
The thing that my favorite song lyric in all of this is the one where she says, I cry a lot, but I am so productive. It's an art. Now, if that doesn't speak to everybody, you know,
we're actually, I think, going to put that on a shirt. I felt that so hard. That whole song, I Can Do It With a Broken Heart, really felt that. She really nails it.
I also loved the song. And like, this is an experience that I'll never have, but I know exactly what it feels like when she says, but daddy, I love him. I'm having his baby. No, not really, but you should see your faces right now. Like, that is the gotcha that we all hope for, that we can all sort of revel in. It's the gotcha that we never get in our own lives, but we know is exactly what would happen, where one second somebody's judging you for something and the next second they're forcing you to be together because now you have this baby or whatever the case may be. It just was so interesting to me, and I loved that.
Also, I think something that you see around the discourse is that like there's a little bit of a loss of understanding the metaphor of that. Like, but daddy, I love him is it's a metaphor for her relationship with the fans even. And something else that I thought was so interesting is that she doesn't often call out the fans. It rarely ever. I don't think she's ever. And in this album, she really went for it. Sarah's and Hannah's in their Sunday best. The fact that people, they only save you because they hate you. If anything, like she's speaking about just celebrity culture and American, the way that America builds people up and then cages them, and they are what you are because you trained.
I thought it was good. Yeah, I think she speaks to the queer audience. Like, you know, I haven't gotten into the Gaylor lore, which I will, and we'll maybe do a whole episode on that. But the way that she makes people like me feel included and seen and heard in a way that you want the pretty popular girl to stick up for you. She did that with a lot of the songs, even though they weren't about the queer experience, you could relate many of them to the queer experience.
There is a reason why the queer talk just don't quit when it comes to Taylor Swift. Mm-hmm. And I think it has much less to do with her actual sexuality than the average person thinks when they hear Gaylor. Mm-hmm. I think it's about like how connected the queer community is to her lyrics and mm-hmm. to the way she has positioned herself and the references she uses. And that is its own beast.
She's a hot Cheeto girl. Do you know what hot Cheeto girl is?
No.
Okay. So when you're growing up and you're a little queer person, right? There's always like some sort of toughy girl who eats hot Cheetos. That's the like stereotype that will stick up for you. To the teacher, to the bullies, to whoever. And Taylor Swift is the hot Cheeto girl of the queer community in so many ways, where she may not have a queer experience, but she's got a lot of queer friends and she cares about them and she's anti-bullying. And she's going to use her popularity and power and the fact that some people are even afraid of her a little bit to protect the queer community. So to me, Taylor Swift is my hot Cheeto girl. I would hope that I would be lab partners with her and that she would protect me from all the evils of high school.
I think that that is exactly what she's going for. I do think there are some people in the Gaylor community who might disagree just because the consensus is like Taylor Swift could easily settle this by just being like, I'm actually straight. I'm mm-hmm. a heterosexual. Because the only ways that she's done that is sort of by alluding to it in a way that can always be considered vague. And mm-hmm. on the flip side, she said things that can be considered vaguely gay in a similar way. So I think that like this lack of willingness to put it to bed, so to speak. And I don't think she should have to, genuinely.
I don't think she can, because if she comes out and says, hey guys, knock it off, I'm not gay, then it kind of makes it seem like being gay is something you wouldn't want to be or whatever. You know what I mean? Like it would be like a little icky.
Lots of artists have done that though. Like Hayley Williams has done that and Lana Del Rey has done that.
I know. I think it's kind of like how the most kind people put their pronouns in their bio, even though they're very clearly born male and he, him, or born female and she, her. They do it to kind of like be a part, normalize the situation, be a part of the community. Some people see it as allyship. Some people see it as annoying. I don't think there's a win for her in coming out and saying what she is or isn't.
Honestly, I don't think that she like should necessarily, but I'm just sharing what that perspective is that like the sort of chasm between those communities. I think people feel that she could sort of in some way do something about it. Honestly, you're right. It's like there's nothing she can do that she would win. And I think the most important thing is that she has made so many people feel seen and has like brought queer culture into so much of her music, which is great and normalizing in its own way. But I'm with you and I like love it.
Yes, I have one criticism, which is both a question and a criticism. And that is, why so many album versions? You know what I mean? Like vinyl is a limited resource. It's expensive. There's a lot of artists who can't press a vinyl record because it's so cost prohibitive. And then Taylor comes out with like four different albums. There are different songs on each one. You really do have to collect them all like Pokemon cards. Then you got the Target specific only album. Is it marketing genius? Is it wasteful? Is it exploiting the fans? I've sort of not landed on an answer for myself here. I mean, I think it's fun. When I like a shirt, I buy it in every color. But like,
that is a pretty common criticism of her, that it's like wasteful. Billie Eilish made a statement about this that she says was not directed towards Taylor. It was directed towards just generally a lot of artists are doing this, that it is wasteful to have all these versions and all these colors. And it takes a lot of production. And like you said, it shuts out the opportunity for smaller artists to be able to press their vinyls because there are only a limited number of factories.
It does feel like an overconsumption push. The idea that like, well, you know, I got the purple one and my friend got the blue one and the blue one actually has the song I wanted on it. And for me to actually have the whole collective, I have to buy them all. Like, it's like the Stanley Cup of it all. Like having one is enough, but you know, I have three.
I think the fact that it's very hard to get all the songs on one vinyl is right. Extremely frustrating. But then again, you can also buy like a CD with
the digital. Yeah.
You could get the digital, like does promote overconsumption. Mm-hmm. And the most Americana thing about Taylor Swift is that she is a queen capitalist and she never stops. I will call it marketing genius from the standpoint of, yes, she's a billionaire who became a billionaire mostly because of her art. Because of her art. I don't see what else it would be. And from her branding. Is it exploitative?
You could argue that people want to collect, you know, a great volume of things. And I do think this plays into the idea that we only criticize things that women want to collect because surely, like, you know, my dad's got like 15 different John Elway t-shirts and we don't give him any shit about overconsuming John Elway t-shirts. But we're going to, you know, anytime it's a women's thing, it's overconsumption and she's been influenced and yeah, all this different kind of stuff.
Right. Like, why are handbags not as legit as a men's watch?
Right.
And that is probably the point that Taylor would make. It's like, oh, you just don't. You just want to tear down a woman because they want the colorful vinyls. And the thing that kind of gets my gears around that when people are like, oh, she's so wasteful.
Mm-hmm.
I want to be like, Taylor Swift is one of the few very, very, very wealthy people who is actually lifting the economy in noticeable ways.
True.
In places that in places that do not get an economic boost. And my point is not about whether we should criticize her for her jet, but whether, like, you don't hear criticism of Jeff Bezos for his jet.
Or the football teams or anybody. Yeah. Any other person that does this. Yeah.
Or Kim Kardashian, really, even. But it's like, OK, Kim Kardashian is not making Minnesota rich for a weekend.
Yeah, that's true.
It's just, it's an interesting conversation.
I'm here for it. I'm here for the community. I think it's something that we can talk about forever and ever and ever. I was concerned about what the concert experience would be like. And my sister said, don't be so dumb. She's going to keep doing an Eras style tour. You don't have to worry about it. And she'll add in some of the songs from this album. And I thought, okay, well, maybe that's how they'll do it. Because I couldn't imagine the album. I was like, what are we going to do? We're going to have like a Lilith fair. We're going to like sit in a field together, dress like fairies. Because I would love that. That I would show up for. Or like a small salon. And it's like an intimate concert.
That would be amazing. I can't see her doing that just because of like the money.
No.
Like, you know, but I would love that. Let's predict what song she's going to add to the Eras Tour. Do you want to do that?
Yes.
Okay. I think she's going to add Florida. I Can Do It With a Broken Heart. I think that'll be the last song.
To be.
That'll be the last song. The new last song.
Mm-hmm. I think But Daddy, I Love Him. So fun.
Yes, definitely.
Has to be.
And maybe So Long London.
Well, yeah, because the ones that she did with like Post Malone and whatnot, you wouldn't really necessarily do that unless he was going to be a special guest, which I would love.
Yeah, maybe she would have him at some point.
Let me put this out there. I love Post Malone. I love him as a person, as an artist, as a piece of artwork to be viewed as just like an inspiration. He's my weight loss goal. He's my face tattoo goal. I just think Post Malone is so cool. I like his wine. I am a Maloney.
If a that postie. Is such a thing.
I'm a postie. No, I'm worse than a post. I'm a Maloney. That's the millennial version. It's like double cringe.
Look, I love him too. I'm a big fan, even though I don't know like all of his music, but I can get into it.
I love that he got his name from a rap name generator. Like just everything about him is stupid and I love stupid.
All right, let's move on to our main news. We have something very exciting for our main news segment today because we talk a lot about minority rule and how one of our core values on the show is pushing for a more representative democracy. I think we all know that one of the biggest structural barriers to that is the Electoral College, which people have been calling out for decades as a problem. But basically, since 2006, post the Bush-Gore fiasco, there's been a major effort to shuffle ball change away from the Electoral College. And with all of the news that is constantly flying, it's possible that many people haven't heard of an initiative that has gained a lot of traction to marginalize the effects of the Electoral College. And this week, Maine became the 17th state to sign on to this initiative called the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. So we want to tell you about that. So the NPVIC, rolls off the tongue, doesn't it, is an agreement among 17 states and DC to award all of their electoral votes automatically to whichever presidential ticket wins the overall popular vote in the country. So in 2016, any state that had joined this compact, their electoral votes would have gone to Hillary Clinton, regardless of how the popular vote was in their state. So now Maine has joined this movement to turn back the electoral college process and just go direct with a popular vote, winner takes all process.
Simi, do you know how the electoral college works? I had to look it back up again because there are so many times in my life where I think I know something and then I'm like, I actually don't know and I need to refresh and there's nothing wrong with that. So for the folks listening at home who are like, I know what it is, but I don't maybe know, I couldn't explain it to you. Here is the TLDR. The term electoral college does not exist in the Constitution, but it was used by the founding fathers, which is why our current Congress is like so obsessed with it. It started as a compromise because back in the day, some folks wanted there to be a clean, popular vote. So one vote, one person, we elect the president directly. But other people thought that the general public was, quote, too stupid to do something as important as elect a president. Okay. So those people wanted the voice of the people to be you elect your congressman and then your congressman, who is a good and stately gentleman, will be the one to cast that ballot for the president because they needed to have some sort of like place between the public and the president, which sometimes looking at the MAGA movement, I now maybe understand that people could be swayed by the cult of personality, maybe more than their Congress could.
But could more than half? Because he didn't win the popular vote either time.
That's very true. So the Electoral College was born as a compromise between these two ideologies, that the public should directly elect the president and that no, Congress should elect the president. And this is going to blow your fucking mind how insane this setup is. First, we have to get electors. Basically, prior to Election Day, both the Democrats and the Republican parties of each state propose a slate of electors and they submit them to the state. Now, your state has the same number of electors as it does members of its congressional delegation. So you get one elector for each member of the House of Representatives, plus your two senators. Doesn't this feels like a little redundant to me, but here we are. So these electors, ironically, are not elected people themselves. They are assigned. And electors are mostly people who have been super loyal or somehow helpful to their party. Then, when you as a citizen go in and vote on Election Day, if more people vote for Joe Biden for president in that state than the Democratic slate of electors that they previously submitted, those people get seated. If more people vote for Trump, then the Republican slate of electors is seated. The first candidate to get 270 electors seated is the winner, and they'll usually call that on election night, but they are not actually the president yet. There is a meeting of the electors. This I definitely did not know. And if you're listening and you're like, I knew this, good on you, because I had no idea that this was going on in the background. After Election Day, there is a meeting of the electors. It's the first Monday after the second Wednesday in December. So it's quite a few weeks after the election. And that is when the president and the vice president are officially voted on by the electors. Yes, there is a vote individually for the president and the vice president. It's not a package deal like it is on our ballot. Now, it's assumed that the electors will just pick who they're supposed to because they are party loyalists, but they don't always have to. There is no constitutional provision or federal law that requires the electors to vote according to the results of the popular vote in their states, which is very spooky. Reference sources indicate that over the past 200 years, more than 700 proposals have been introduced to Congress to reform or eliminate the Electoral College, because again, it's super redundant and it's silly. And it's, you know, anytime you add these middlemen, you introduce the possibility for error. And there have been more proposals for constitutional amendments on changing the Electoral College than on any other subject. This state winner-takes-all law encourages candidates to focus disproportionately on a limited set of swing states, as small changes in a popular vote in a swing state can produce large changes in the Electoral College vote. It's why New York, with millions of people, doesn't have as much electoral power as like Montana.
Right. And also why candidates are always just basically in like Ohio and Arizona and Michigan. And I mean, it depends what the swing states are. You know, Iowa used to be more of a swing state and it kind of evolves. But all of these like little intricacies were exposed during 2020. If you remember, like getting to each step of the electors confirming Joe Biden as the president was precarious. Like I remember this December meeting, I believe it was December 14th. I'm so traumatized. And it was like, are they going to vote for Joe Biden? It was genuinely a question. And then on January 6th, that was it, what it was about. It was about stopping the certification of the electors in Congress, which is a procedural thing that no one clocked for decades. And each step is like now critical.
Well, what's tricky is, yes, 2020 exposed this situation with the electors, and they realized that, like, they weren't going to get it done that way. This is when they were trying to convince Mike Pence that he could actually just decide who the president was and that it didn't matter what any of the electors or the votes said. Of course, that's far too exposed for anybody to accept, especially in this day and age. So what they're trying to do now is mess with the 270. If a candidate does not get the 270 votes, the 270 electors that are required to be considered the assumed president, Congress does vote for the president. This hasn't happened since like the 1800s or something, when there used to be like four and five political parties, but it's very possible that it could happen again this time. And RFK Jr. is the problem that we have. And his New York campaign manager actually said very openly in a video that this is one of the goals of RFK's run for president. If he can't win the presidency, which he knows that he can't, then he hopes to at least ensure that Trump does win, as Biden is Trump and RFK's mutual enemy. And if Trump nor Biden can get 270 electors, then it would go to the currently Republican-controlled Congress to vote on who the president is. And of course, with their one-vote majority, they would seat Trump.
We need to get to the bottom of why Robert F. Kennedy is so obsessed with getting Trump elected.
I think his brain is broken, as we talked about in that episode, you know, where we did our deep dive on RFK Jr. If you haven't listened to it, you need to go back and listen to it. It's some of our most thorough work to date on just the history of him and where he's gone to. Even the environmental groups that he worked with in the past, where he is, you know, an icon, a titan of environmental policy, have turned their back on him also and say there is something wrong with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. now. He's not the man that we worked with. He's not the person we once know. And we are not supporting him or his candidacy. We think that he is a great danger to the overall safety and climate of this world, because, you know, obviously Trump doesn't have great climate policy. And if he becomes the president, then we're going to see a lot of rollbacks on the things that Biden's been able to do. Overall, the Electoral College sucks. It's redundant. And we can blame Alexander Hamilton and his Federalist Paper number 68 for it.
They needed a compromise.
They did back then, because we were making compromises with people who literally thought it was okay to own humans. It wasn't okay. Like, we can't be living in the 1800s anymore. We have all the shitty laws of the Victorian era and none of the fun parts, right? I can't get prescribed cocaine for my cough anymore. I can't make art out of my friend's hair anymore. Like, we don't have the cool little outfits. All we have is our shitty laws. And so I think that we should probably do what the founding fathers hoped we would do and evolve the Constitution and, you know, operate on the popular vote, where one person, one vote.
Well, I do have one suggestion. This is a good thing to lobby your state representatives on. If you do want to really like take an action for democracy, like, this is a great thing to call your state officials about. It's not necessarily on their docket yet, but you could do it, tell your friends to do it, tell your family to do it, and this can really gain a lot of traction. So far, there's only 17 states in DC signed on, so lots more to go.
Got a ways to go, ways to go. And again, this is called the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact.
NPVIC.
NPVIC, and that's how you can switch your state from participating in the Electoral College to going direct with the popular vote.
All right, I think this takes us to our down ballot era. In honor of Taylor Swift's song Florida, we are talking about the Florida Senate race and the Democratic nominee who's running against current Florida Senator Rick Scott. Her name is Debbie Mucarcel Powell. She's awesome. She has already served as a U.S. representative from 2019 to 2021 in part of Miami-Dade County, but she was defeated in her 2020 bid for re-election. As you know, Florida went very red in that election. But Debbie Mucarcel Powell is awesome. She is actually the first Ecuadorian-American and the first South American-born immigrant to serve in Congress. And she's passionate about reproductive care, climate change, lowering drug costs, and protecting Social Security and Medicare, common sense gun reform. And because she's running in Florida, where they are enacting their abortion ban, and there is going to be an abortion referendum on that ballot in November, she actually has a real chance here. Mm-hmm. So if you live in Florida, if you know people in Florida, make sure to spread the word about Debbie Mucarcel Powell as your new alternative to Rick Scott. Just one moment for Rick Scott for a second. Lest we forget, he was the CEO of his company when the DOJ won 14 felony convictions against it for defrauding Medicare, Medicaid, and other federal programs. His company was then fined a record, at the time, $1.7 billion in the largest healthcare fraud settlement in the U.S. up until then. So you could have this guy, or you could have Debbie McCarcel Powell, who's passionate about reproductive care, protecting Social Security, Medicare, or the guy who literally defrauded it. So we're really excited about Debbie McCarcel Powell. Check her out. Tell everyone you know and support her campaign. I think it's debbieforflorida.com.
Love her. And I've loved the letters that we've been getting about our down ballot girlies. I want to shout out a listener who made that Elect Hose campaign website that we talked about last week. Girl, I can't believe people gave you sass about that in your real life. Me and Sammy are here to be your new best friends and support you in your Elect Hose era. We were proud of that campaign. It obviously reached the right people. And this woman who wrote in, who's a friend of the pod, is a web designer, and she's actually looking for a job right now. So if you are a person who is hiring, looking for web designers or e-commerce engineers, we would love to pass along her information to you because we are a job board now. Let's talk about somebody else that I love to hear about, which is Senator John Ossoff of Georgia and the way that he addressed the Postmaster General villain of our time, Louis DeJoy. You know what I love? I love when people do old-timey things, and I felt like he did this old-timey thing. So the Postmaster General is just like an absolute nightmare, and the mail has been a disaster. I'm sure everybody's been feeling it. We're going to get into who this guy is and why he is. But Senator Ossoff calls him in for a hearing on why the mail is late, and he's sitting there, and he's like, did you get my letter? And DeJoy's like, I don't know, maybe my people did. He's like, no, I sent a letter as a senator to the Postmaster General. Did you get my letter? And he's like, no. He's like, are you saying that you ignore the United States mail? Do you not read your mail? Like, and it was the fucking best. And then he's like, Postmaster, the mail in Atlanta is late and the people of Georgia deserve an answer. And I thought it was just like the most old timey, tough guy thing that he wrote him a letter. Let's play the clip.
I wrote you on March 14th. Did you get my letter?
My office probably. My office guy.
Well, I didn't write your office. I wrote you. Did you receive my letter?
I have not read your letter.
You haven't read my letter.
I tried to speak to you Friday or yesterday.
You haven't read my letter.
I have.
The mail's not on time in Georgia. I'm a member of the committee of jurisdiction. You haven't read my letter. Well, that explains why I haven't received a response to my letter. March 14th, I wrote you with two specific questions. What update can you provide regarding the aforementioned reported issues at the Atlanta Regional Processing and Distribution Center in Palmetto? Question one. Question two, how is USPS currently communicating with customers in the Metro Atlanta area reporting delayed and lost packages? You haven't read the letter?
So letters come in, people put, they put stuff together to answer it and get.
Let me just give you just a friendly piece of advice. You should personally read letters from members of the U.S. Senate committee that funds and oversees your operations, particularly where you are failing abysmally to fulfill your core mission in my state. And let me be clear, I think postal workers are out there every single day working their hearts out to deliver the mail on time. But if they don't have the infrastructure and the management competence overhead them to make a transition like this without drastically impairing the core function of the Postal Service, everyone in my state is losing.
Okay, how great is that? I mean, I'm a lesbian, but that was hot. That was hot stuff. That was hot stuff, Ossoff. All right, let's talk about somebody who's not hot, though. So who is this Louis DeJoy character? He's not great. He's our villain of the week. So Louis DeJoy was the founder and CEO of New Breed Logistics, a major Republican Party donor and one of the leading fundraisers for Trump in 2020, giving $1.2 million to the Trump campaign and another $1.2 million to the RNC. And it did not stop there. He got assigned to be the Postmaster General after having exactly zero experience at USPS. And his company holds contracts with USPS, which has been seen by many as not just a conflict of interest, but a wee bit corrupt even. DeJoy is a Republican bestie, and he's been one since his wife served as an ambassador under George W. Bush's administration. This guy's career has pretty well always been clouded by controversy. In 2001, an audit found the USPS had given New Breed Logistics, his company, non-competitive contracts worth more than $300 million, starting in 1992. When George Sr. was president, longtime Republican bestie here. This audit of New Breed Logistics back in the early 2000s, late 90s, concluded that if the bidding had been competitive, taxpayers could have saved $53 million. This is your Postmaster General now, who has this history of corruption with the post office. And in September of 2020, so very recently, the Washington Post and the New York Times reported that according to former employees at DeJoy's logistics company, he participated in a straw donor scheme which is he was accused of reimbursing employees for making political donations. As you know, you can only donate so much to a political candidate. So instead, he was like having his employees donate, and then he was reimbursing them for their donations to just try and funnel as much money as possible to Trump. Now he says, nuh-uh, no, I didn't.
But this was reported while Donald Trump was trying to undermine mail-in voting, and they were trying to delegitimize mail-in voting legally. But it was also at a time where he was actively part of the scheme to, or the attempts to undermine the 2020 election.
DeJoy was appointed just months after Trump's Office of Management and Budget released recommendations that the USPS should be privatized, which absolutely gives me chills. So anyway, he gets in as the Postmaster General, and the result has been the slow decimation of one of America's most treasured institutions. So DeJoy's 10-year Delivering for America plan is the roadmap to destroying rural, indigenous, and small communities who are too small to have private shipping offices nearby. Because, you know, of course, Republicans are always like, well, we have FedEx and UPS and all this other stuff. We don't need the post office. Yes, we do. There are people in these small communities who rely on the post office to vote by mail because they're not even big enough to host polling places. And private companies like the ones that DeJoy and Republicans seem to think should take over USPS won't build offices in rural and remote areas because it's not profitable. Those companies rely on the USPS for last mile delivery. So even if you send something through FedEx, you know, you'll see if you live in a rural area or a small town that it gets delivered by USPS. So all of that would be gone.
Also, if you have a private company in charge of the mail, they can make any rules, which could be that they can open your mail, whereas like now it's a felony to open someone's mail. So there's a lot of different hazards associated with this. And I know it's like mail, it's not, you know, it's not sexy, but it is sexy, actually. It can be very sexy.
It's very sexy. And you can get sex toys and sex products through the mail right now. And if the Heritage Foundation has their way, they're going to convince you that we don't need the USPS because we have email. Well, how are we supposed to get our vibrators and contraceptives if not for the USPS? Okay. The post office is one of the few federal agencies that is explicitly authorized by the Constitution. So it is a little bit harder to break.
Unlike the Electoral College,
unfortunately, public schools and prisons, which we've seen what happens when we privatize those institutions, they just get shittier.
Totally. I mean, I think this speaks to a bigger, more oligarchic trend. I mean, he owns a competitive shipping company. He wants to see the USPS to fund it as a public utility. So then people will have to use his company or a bigger conglomerate. And it's really emblematic of how they want to break everything. They want to break public health care, the housing market, the education system, just privatize everything so wealthier white men can get more control, and that electability does not matter because they're able to just buy everything, buy elections through Citizens United. And this is not like a new thought. I mean, we've had Sarah Kendzior on our shows before. She always says they want to break up the US and sell it for parts. This is part of that. They want to force people back into a religious society, even as people are becoming more secular. And the post office is one of the few things that like makes that is a mostly untouched public utility. And because it's not sexy, so they don't want to touch it. This stands for more than just, you know, your mail is slow.
It's just, it's another thing that just isn't going right. And it's another reason why we have to continue to vote. Now, a lot of folks are like, how come if the Postmaster General is appointed, this non-elected position is appointed by the president and Trump appointed DeJoy, how come Biden can't just appoint who he wants? It's very much like Supreme Court justices. You can't just switch them over. So for DeJoy to be taken out of office, it would require the U.S. Postal Board to fire him. It requires a unanimous vote on him being removed, and DeJoy has a seat on that board. So, of course, he's not going to vote for himself to be out of a job, which is why it has so far been impossible for Biden to replace him.
How can you replace anyone if they have a unanimous vote?
These are the little tricks and loopholes that the Republican lawyers are so incredible at finding that they've worked this out to. So Biden has been chipping away at the U.S. Postal Board. He has replaced three people who were Republican appointees who retired with Democratic appointees. So now it really is down to DeJoy and just one other person who won't vote to replace DeJoy. I will say in the last year, he has been under immense pressure to behave better, and he's doing little things that are helpful. Like he tried to buy all gas vehicles when Biden wanted all electric vehicles, and he compromised and said, okay, fine, we'll do electric vehicles. So Biden is getting his way. He is pushing DeJoy to act a little bit better. And DeJoy is a little bit of a wants to be the special boy. And so he's going to continue to advocate for Donald Trump to be the president. But if Donald Trump isn't the president, then I bet we would see DeJoy maybe compromise even a little bit more as Biden keeps the intense pressure on him to act right and to ensure that the mail is running properly. DeJoy is a person who doesn't like to be embarrassed, even though he's doing very embarrassing things. So stuff like John Ossoff calling him into Congress and putting him on C-SPAN and making him answer to these things and calling him a bad businessman, that's affecting him. And we need to keep that kind of pressure up. Bully the rich, bully the oligarchs.
We like a man with a little bit of shame. Can be constructive.
So that's what's up with that. That's what's up with that.
It's a variety hour. I've been loving it. V, I'm so excited. 2 days till we take the town.
2 days till we take the town. And we will be certainly making Taylor Swift memes and TikToks throughout the weekend. So go ahead and follow us at Under the Desk News, at Betches News, at Sammy. Isn't that yours? S-A-M-I?
It is. At Sammy. Honestly, say hi to us if you see us in D.C. Email
Please
us.
Do.
If you don't, I feel like that's our show today.
Until next time, I'm Vitus Spear.
I'm Sammy Sage.
And this is American Fever Dream. American Fever Dream is hosted by Vitus Spear and Sammy Sage. The show is produced by Rebecca Sausmacat, Jorge Morales-Pico, and Rebecca Steinberg. Editing by Rebecca Sausmacat. Social media by Bridget Schwartz. And be sure to follow Betches News on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok.
Betches.